Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
The title of this talk is Truth, Goodness, and Fantasy Literature. The subtitle is twofold. So the subtitle that I have here is more sort of descriptive, right? But less kind of eye-catching and attention-grabbing. So the subtitle I'm giving you here is Thomistic Reflections on the Rise of a Subgenre. The alternative subtitle, which is really kind of the catalyst for why I wrote this talk in the first place, is this. Is J.R.R. Tolkien better than George R.R. Martin? So George R.R. Martin is the author of the book series that gave rise to the HBO miniseries Game of Thrones, or HBO series Game of Thrones. So is Tolkien better than Martin, right? Is Lord of the Rings better than Game of Thrones? And so this was a question that was posed to me by a particularly tenacious student of mine, and because he wouldn't give up on this idea, I ended up writing this talk to just shut him up. And it turns out that it's a really fun talk. And so my hope is that you'll see that. So it's equal parts playful and also an opportunity to do some really rich and serious Thomistic philosophy. So that's what we're going to be doing. So the plan for the talk is fairly simple. First, I'm going to offer you some reflections on the state of the question in recent fantasy literature. Then we're going to pivot to Aquinas' theoretical account of truth and goodness. And then we will apply that general theoretical account of truth and goodness to art at a kind of generic level and fantasy literature as a particular type of art in a more specific way. And that will let us answer the question with which we began. So, reflections on recent fantasy literature. So, fantasy literature has come a long way since the time of J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis. It has branched out into a vast panoply of different subgenres. So, here's just one little kind of image that gives you a smattering of fantastic subgenres. So there's magical realism, there's dark fantasy, there's fairy tale fantasy, there's low fantasy, urban fantasy, historical fantasy, heroic fantasy, etc., etc. Here's a different categorization of subgenres: urban, steampunk, lit RPG fantasies, high fantasies, weird west fantasies, occult detective fantasies, right? So I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time looking at all of these, but I just want to give you the sense that it's the number of subgenres within fantasy literature is pretty vast at this point, and the number is only growing. So here are just some ways to kind of orient us with respect to the subgenres. So there are different ways that you can divide genres of fantasy literature. So one way to divide is based on magic, right? So it seems like all fantasy is going to have magic. And so the magic-based divisions goes like this. There's high fantasy, where there's lots of magic. And there's low fantasy, where there's only little or minimal magic. But there's another way that you can kind of divide into fantasy into subgenres. You can do it just based on the setting, right? So you've got other world fantasy, where the entire plot, the entire story sort of takes place in a fantasy world. So think, with some caveats, right? Think Lord of the Rings. Another kind of fantasy is what's often referred to as portal fantasy. So this is where the main character travels to another world from the real world, right? And if you want a classic example of this, it would be Lewis's Narnia, right? So the children begin in this world and then go through the wardrobe to the new fantastic world of Narnia. Urban fantasies are just fantasies that take place in a city, right? And it could be, it could be a fantasy city. It could, just any kind of urban setting. Historical fantasies take place in an alternate version of the past. And contemporary fantasies take place in an alternate version of the present. You've also got a completely different way of dividing up the subgenres that's based on the characters involved. So you can have coming-of-age fantasies, right? A traditional Bildungsroman kind of fantasy, where the main character grows from childhood into adulthood. And so Sister Mary Sheila and I were talking about one fantasy series, young adult fantasy series that both of us really like, called The Chronicles of Prydain, that falls squarely into this, right? The main character begins in book one as a young boy, and you kind of watch him grow into a man over the course of the books. You've also got, there's a subgenre called anti-heroic fantasy, right? Where so the main character is someone who's not necessarily morally gray, right? But just someone who's deeply flawed, right? So the main character has like some kind of very serious character flaw. You know, either he's an out and out coward, right? Or he's a drunkard, or, you know, but has some serious defect in character, such that it's really hard to say that the main character is unambiguously good. He's not like your Aragorn, right? From Lord of the Rings. Now, all those different subgenres can and often do overlap in ways that give rise to, you know, an almost innumerable number of possibilities. So you can have high anti-heroic portal fantasy. And an illustration of this is so Stephen R. Donaldson's Chronicles of Thomas Covenant, the Unbeliever, the first book of the first trilogy is called Lord Falsbane. But that's, you know, that came out, you know, that was part of like the first generation of fantasy after that was really inspired by Tolkien and Lewis. You can have high urban historical fantasy. This is one of my favorites. Again, I was talking with Sister earlier today about this. So Susanna Clarke's Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell it's a historical fantasy. It takes place in an alternate version of Victorian or kind of Napoleonic era England, where, you know, you just think like Napoleonic era England, but just with magic, right? And there's been magic in England since the reign of the Raven King, right? And yet it takes, the majority of the action takes place in cities, right? But magic plays a large role, so it's high as opposed to low. You can have low contemporary coming of age fantasy, right? And so Laura Esquirel's Like Water for Chocolate would be a good example of this particular intersection of subgenres. And on and on and on, right? So pick any of those various kinds of divisions, and you can just lay them one, overlap one on top of the other, and you're almost certainly going to be able to find some book that represents that intersection of genres. Now, of all the vast panoply of subgenres within fantasy literature, there's one that I think should strike us as especially troubling. That is a subgenre that is often referred to as grimdark fantasy. So, grimdark fantasy usually is seen as beginning in 1984, which is pretty early in the various subgenres, but it begins with Glenn Cook's The Black Company. Even the cover is kind of ominous, right? But it continues. So in 1996, you have another very significant representation of this subgenre in George R. R. Martin's Game of Thrones. So here's the original cover of, you know, the Game of Thrones, which is the first volume in Martin's series. The grimdark subgenre continues in 2006 with Joe Abercrombie's The Blade Itself. It continues, it goes on further in 2008 with Richard Morgan's The Steel Remains, and in 2011 with Mark Lawrence's A Prince of Thorns. So I hope you're getting the sense that there are a lot of representatives of this grimdark subgenre within fantasy. And then in 2020, you have Rob Hayes's Along the Razor's Edge. Okay, but what is it, right? So we've seen that it's got a pretty long history among the various subgenres within fantasy. But what actually is grimdark fantasy? Well, I'm going to offer you a couple definitions or descriptions of the subgenre that come from fantasy authors themselves, right? So rather than me eisegetically imposing some kind of, you know, a priori Thomist definition, I'll just give you, here's what fantasy authors say about this genre. So N.K. Jemisin, who's one of the most awarded recent fantasy authors, just describes grimdark this way. She says, it's got dark, broken worlds with dark, broken characters. Adam Roberts gives this as a kind of quasi-definition. He says, grimdark fantasies are fantasies that turn their backs on the more uplifting pre-Raphaelite visions of idealized medievalia, and instead stress how nasty, brutish, short, and dark life back then, quote-unquote, really was. And for Roberts, those are supposed to be scare quotes, right? So he thinks that grimdark fantasy is not any more realistic a representation of kind of like the medieval era than high fantasy or epic fantasy or something like that. But it presents itself as being, he thinks it's kind of constitutive of grimdark, that it presents itself as being more realistic. Michael J. Sullivan says that grimdark fantasy novels are novels where all the characters seem mired in a morass of hopelessness. Their lives are weighed down by misery. There is no possibility for joy and no reason to aspire to anything, because in the end, there is no chance of a better life or a greater good. You can see grimdark is like that's a nice, quippy, simple way of capturing what's going on here. Liz Bork defines it this way. She says, it's a subgenre that values its gritty realism and that attempts to overturn long established heroic tropes. And then she says, its defining characteristic lies in a retreat into the valorization of darkness for darkness's sake, into a kind of nihilism that portrays right action in terms of personal morality as either impossible or futile. That's grimdark. Right, so that's the subgenre. So if, you know, I think most people who are cued in, you know, even guys who wear 13th century outfits, right, have heard of Game of Thrones, right? You know, HBO is like pretty famous, right? So, but this is the subgenre into which, you know, things as popular as a Game of Thrones falls, right? So it's one example of this. So the core question that I want to talk about with you and think through tonight is this. Is grimdark fantasy, that particular subgenre, less true, less good than other fantasy subgenres? And in particular, than classic fantasy that you get in the likes of J.R.R. Tolkien? So that can kind of be subdivided, I think, into two questions. First, is grimdark fantasy less true than classic fantasy? Second, is it less good than classic fantasy? Now, my gut answer, probably unsurprisingly, is yeah, of course, right? Just look at those descriptions / definitions. Seems like it should be obvious. But I am a philosopher. And as a philosopher and as a Thomist, I can't just go with my gut on these things. I can't just emotively react and say grimdark, yuck, right? You know, I need to ask myself, can I give a reasoned, philosophical, Thomistic answer to this core question, i.e. to these two sub-questions? And I think I can. So that's what we're going to set out to do. And I think the right, because the two sub-questions are just about whether it's more true and whether it's more good, I think the right way for us to do this in a principled Thomistic way is to begin by looking at Aquinas on truth and goodness and see if he presents us with principles that can then be applied. And, spoiler, he does. So, first, let's start with Aquinas' definitions. So Aquinas gives as a kind of working definition of truth this. It's the correspondence between thing and intellect, or the correspondence between thing and mind. Goodness, the working definition, just goes like this. What satisfies desire, right? So goodness is the thing that satisfies a desire. So whenever we desire something, we're desiring it precisely as good. We're seeing it as the sort of thing that could satisfy whatever my need or longing or yearning is. Now, at this point, most Thomists would hear truth and goodness, see these definitions, and then run straight to a very famous doctrine of St. Thomas, which is called the doctrine of the transcendentals. So the transcendentals are features that are, in the technical lingo, it's convertible. So you can kind of think of that as like interchangeable with, or in contemporary philosophy, coextensive with being, right? So the idea is this: every being is a unity, and every unity is a being. Every being is a thing, every thing is a being, right? So thing and being are interchangeable. They're coextensive, right? If you Venn diagram thing and being, you just have a circle, right? So there's no example of a thing that's not a being. There's no example of a being that's not a thing. And so famously, in Aquinas' doctrine of the transcendentals, he has not just being and thing and unity, but he also has truth and goodness. So he thinks every being is in some sense true, and everything that is true is a being, right? Every being is in some sense good, and every good thing is a being, right? So these also are convertible or interchangeable or coextensive. So most Thomists, as soon as they hear, you know, truth and goodness, their minds go straight to the transcendentals. So that's the sense in which everything corresponds to the intellect, right? So remember, truth is just correspondence of thing and mind, right? But like, everything corresponds to the mind. Why? Well, because everything can be understood, right? Everything is at root, in principle, intelligible. So just insofar as something is, it's also understandable, intelligible, knowable. And likewise, everything satisfies desire, just insofar as it is, right? So pick anything you want, right? And you're gonna be able to find something attractive about it, right? I'll give you an example of like I'll pick the hardest case for myself, right? So something that just, it seems to every human being, just obviously true that there's like nothing good about cats, right? And yet, nevertheless, right? So like, cats were made by God, right? And insofar as cats are made by God, they have to be in some sense good, right? God wanted there to be cats, right? Now, evil is a deep mystery, right? And so we can't really unravel why God wanted to make cats, but he did. And insofar as he did, right, like our minds have to assent to the fact that there must be something good about cats. There must be something desirable about cats. Otherwise, God wouldn't have made it, right? So, I mean, it's an easier example to see would be death. It's much easier to understand why there would be death than cats, right? But like St. Ambrose teaches us that, look, like if we had everlasting life in a fallen state, then going on to live forever would be worse than finally having an end of, you know, our fallen sinfulness. And so death is preferable to fallen immortal life. All of us understand that, right? So death, scrutable. Cats, a little bit less scrutable. But nevertheless, right, we can find something. We can find some good that in the fallen state death yields. And we can find some good, hypothetically, in cats, right? So everything that is good, everything that is true. But if that's our approach, right, understood in that transcendental sense, then the answer to our core question is actually trivial, right? And the answer would be trivially no, right? So if all we have is the transcendental sense of truth and the transcendental sense of goodness, where literally everything is true and literally everything is good, then grimdark fantasy is not less true or less good than classic fantasy, than Tolkien. Why? Well, because Tolkien-style fantasy exists and grimdark fantasy exists. And insofar as they both exist, they're both true. Insofar as they both exist, they're both good. So, answer, no. But I'm still going to go with my gut here, right? I want the answer to be yes, right? And so what we need to do in order to get the no answer, right, or the yes answer, is to recognize that for St. Thomas, there are other really important senses of truth and goodness that are not the transcendental truth and not the transcendental good. And those are the ones that we need to look to if we want to ask and answer this question in any sense that's not trivial. So here's a big chunky quote from Aquinas's disputed question on truth. He says, I'll break this down for you, but he says, the completion of any motion or operation is in its end point. But the motion or change of a cognitive power, a knowing power, terminates or ends in the soul. For it is necessary that knowledge be in the knower in a way appropriate to the knower. Whereas the motion of an appetitive power, right, an appetite, a desire, terminates or ends in the thing that is desired. This is why Aristotle posits a kind of circularity in the soul's actions. For the thing outside the soul moves the mind, then the thing as understood in the mind moves the appetite, and then the appetite, the desire, reaches out to attain the thing from which the motion began. So you get this kind of circle. Now, since the word true expresses the order of a being to the appetite, since good expresses the order of a being to the appetite, and true expresses its order to the mind or the intellect, that explains why Aristotle says that good and bad are in things, while truth and falsity are in the mind. But a thing can't be called true unless it corresponds to the intellect. Thus, he says, truth is found primarily in the intellect, in the mind, and secondarily in things. So, there's a lot there. Let's break it down. I think here's what we're getting from that passage. So, the mind, the relationship between mind and thing, or mind and world, is kind of the inverse of the relationship between like will or appetite or desire and thing and world, right? So the will is ecstatic in its orientation. It reaches out. It sort of impels us outwards. Whereas the fundamental relationship of the mind to things is informative, right? So when we understand something, there's some sense in which the form of the thing informs our mind when we know it. Whereas when we want it, right, the will, the desiring power, sort of stretches out or reaches out from us towards the thing. And so there's a difference between precisely because these relationships are asymmetrical, they move in different directions. What we say is primarily true and what we say is primarily good is different in the two cases. So the thing, when you have an information relation, it's the mind that's informed. It's the mind that receives the information that is primarily true or false, right? So either I understand that cats are mostly bad, right? In which case my mind is true, right? Or I'm in error and think that cats are basically good, right? And then you have the false, right? But it's not, what's primarily true is my understanding, right? My judgment about cats. That's what's primarily true or primarily false. And then it's only in a kind of secondary sense that we say that the cat itself is true or false. Whereas you get a difference with the will, right? When I want a dog, right? The thing that's primarily good in that we basically say is good in a kind of absolute sense in that case is the dog, right? That's why I want it. Right? I want it because it's good, right? And no human worries about that, right? Everyone knows that dogs are good, right? So you want the dog because it is good. And then there's a kind of secondary sense in which we can say that I have a good will or I have a good desire, right? Why do I have a good will or a good desire? Well, because I'm wanting or desiring a good thing, right? So the primacy of goodness is in the thing and secondarily in the will or the desire. Whereas it's flipped in the case of truth, right? The thing that's primarily true is the thought, right? The judgment. And the thing that's secondarily true, right, is the thing about which I'm thinking. Okay. Another big chunky quote. Don't worry. Don't be scared. We'll make it. So this particularly has to do with goodness. So St. Thomas says that God alone is good by essence, essentially good. For each thing is called good insofar as it is perfect. But the perfection of a thing is threefold. First, insofar as it is constituted in its being, just insofar as it exists, right? That's the transcendental sense of goodness that we were talking about earlier. Second, a thing is good to the extent that accidents necessary for its perfect operation are added to it. Third, on account of the fact that it attains some other thing as its end. For example, examples are nice. The first perfection of fire consists in its being, which it has through its substantial form. So it's just its existence, right? So the first goodness of fire is just that it exists. Its second perfection consists in its being hot, light, dry, and other such things. So it having the sort of characteristic features that are typical of and perfective of fire. Its third perfection is its coming to rest in its proper place. So Aquinas thought that fire goes up and earth goes down. You can think, you know, whenever you light a candle, right? Where's the flame flicker, right? The flame goes up, right? And you can turn the candle this way and the flame will still go up. You can turn the candle that way. It'll still kind of point up. And so the idea is that the fire wants, in a certain sense, right, to have a particular orientation, right? This threefold perfection doesn't pertain to any creature by essence, but only to God, of whom alone his essence is his existence, and to whom no accidents or like other characteristics are added, because things are said accidentally of God, things that ordinarily for us would be accidents, like wisdom and mercy and love, actually in God, that just is God, right? So you can have for St. Thomas, the simplicity principle. When it comes to divine simplicity, is very easy. It's just, it goes like this. Anything in God is God. Right? That's divine simplicity. Anything in God is God. So is there mercy in God? Yeah. And guess what? God is mercy. Is there love in God? Yep. Guess what? God is love. Is there a father in God? Yes. And guess what? God is the father, right? So anything in God is God. So in God, he is, right? Is existence in God? Yes. So God is his existence. Are there accidents in God like mercy and love? Well, yes. So he just is all of those. And he's not ordered to anything else as an end, right? God doesn't have any goal beyond himself. He is the goal, right? So again, divine simplicity. So all three of the things that in us creatures are different kinds of goodness, different forms of goodness, different levels or grades of goodness, in God, they're just all united in divine simplicity. So we can kind of think of it like this. So in the created world, you start with a thing that's primarily good. And then you can think of it as primarily good with reference to its being, right? Just as it exists. You can subsequently think of it as primarily good with respect to its accidents. So it having all of the characteristic features that it ought to have, right? So compare this, right? So imagine two dogs. One of them has four legs, one of them has three legs. Which one is more perfect, right? Obviously the four-legged dog, right? Something is missing, something is incomplete in the three-legged dog, right? And so that's the kind of perfection that's going on here, or the kind of goodness that's going on here. And then ultimately, you can talk about whether it achieves its final end. So compare two four-legged dogs, right? One of which is like, so I grew up with golden retrievers, right? So imagine two four-legged golden retrievers, one of which is in a field actively going out and retrieving a ball that's been thrown for it and is like coming back to you. And it's just like, it like endlessly, eternally, is engaged in that, right? And compare that to a four-legged golden retriever that's like shut inside. Which one is better? Right? Which one is more perfect as a golden retriever? The one that's actively retrieving, right, in a beautiful meadow with its master, right? It's like, it's frolicking, it's flourishing, right? It's really thriving, right? So that's the third sense of goodness. And the important thing here is to recognize that this graded sense of goodness is also hierarchical, right? So the best instance is something that's got all three, right? Slightly good, but still slightly less good, is something that's only got the first two senses. And then far less good is something that's only got the first sense, right? So now here, so like how many dogs fully flourish in the sense that I just described? So sadly, very few, right? Now, happily, many more dogs flourish in like the first two senses, right? And unfortunately, some dogs only are good in the first sense, right? And those are the ones that live kind of sad lives, right? And you hope that someone will adopt them, right? They're the ones that Sarah McLachlan sings songs about, right? So you've got this graded sense of goodness. Okay, so St. Thomas says, we must understand, however, that a thing is related to the practical intellect. So now we're moving to truth, right? So we've got graded senses of goodness. Now we're going to get graded senses of truth. So a thing is related to the practical intellect in a different way than to the speculative intellect. For the practical intellect causes the thing, and so is the measure of the thing that it brings about. Whereas the speculative intellect, when we're just kind of thinking about things in the abstract, because it receives something from the things, then the mind, the speculative intellect, is in some way moved by those things, and so the things are the measure of it. So notice that the measuring relation is different there, right? So in practical intellect, the mind is the measure, and the thing made is measured by the mind. In speculative thought, the thing is the measure, and the mind is measured by the thing. And from this, he thinks it's clear that the natural things from which our intellect acquires knowledge measure our intellect. So, for example, the nature of cats as fundamentally really bad, right, is the measure of our minds when we think about cats, right? So if you think, no, cats are like fantastic creatures and much better than dogs, right? That, and I say to you, no, dogs are much better than cats, right? What the way to adjudicate our dispute is to appeal to the nature of the things, right? You have to look to cats, right, and see that they're bad, right? And look to dogs and see that they're good, right? And then the difference in the natures of those two animals are what measure the judgments of our minds, right? And so our minds have to measure up to the natures of the things involved, right? And we achieve truth to the extent that our minds measure up to the things that we're thinking about. We fall from truth, right, and make false judgments precisely to the extent that our minds fail to measure up to the things that we're thinking about in speculative thought. So we get something like this. So for speculative thought, the mind receives from the natural thing, like our mind receives from the natural thing. So the natural thing is the measure, and our mind is measured. Whereas in practical intellect, the mind is the measure and causes. So like, it, suppose one of you, for some very strange reason, decided that you were going to like you were going to whittle a wooden cat, right? And like make a cat out of wood. I'm not sure why you're picking a cat rather than a dog, but let's, you know, maybe you have some kind of like strange malformation in your history, right? You've got a lot of baggage, right? And so you decide that you're going to carve a cat, right? Well, the measure of the truth of the wooden whittled cat is your mind. Right? So what did you set out to do? Right? So like if you had a plan in your mind for what you wanted it to look like, and then when you're done, it doesn't look anything like what you had in mind, right? Then it has failed to live up to your plan, right? It has failed to measure up to the idea that you had in your mind. Okay, now it's gonna get even more complicated, but still intelligible. So don't worry. Yeah, brace yourself, strap in, it'll all be okay. So St. Thomas says that, he says, well, wait a minute. We've been talking about truth as correspondence between thing and intellect. And I just introduced, right, some distinctions between kinds of like intellectual relations, right? So practical intellection versus speculative intellection. But there's another distinction that we need to introduce, which is kinds of things and kinds of minds. So he says, look, natural things are themselves measured by the divine mind, in which all things, right, even natural things like cats and dogs and humans, are like artifacts in the mind of the divine artificer. In this way, therefore, the divine intellect is a measure, but nothing measures it. Whereas the natural thing is in one sense a measure, and in another sense is measured. Why? Well, because the natural thing is measured by God's mind and is a measure for our minds when we know it speculatively. And our intellect is measured by and not a measure of natural things, right? No matter how much you want cats to be good, right? No matter how much you want cats to be better than dogs, you can't with your mind make cats better than dogs, right? It's just a fact of nature that they're not, right? And so our human mind is only able to measure up or not to the reality of things, right? We can't measure things. But there is something we can measure, right? Rather, St. Thomas says, our minds are measures of artificial things, right? So your mind is a measure for the wooden whittled cat, right? When I decide that I'm going to create like a doorknob, right? I can decide what shape it's going to have. I can decide what materials it's going to be made out of, et cetera, right? And there are some things that are going to be more or less suitable for that, right? So making a doorknob out of bubbles is probably going to be impossible, right? Making a doorknob out of razor blades, right, is possible but not advisable, right? Making a doorknob out of either wood or smooth metal, right, possible and advisable, right? But the particular doorknob that I'm making, right, is it as an artifact, as an artificial thing, is just measured by my mind, right? I decide what artifact I'm going to make, right? And it either comes out right or comes out wrong. And whether it comes out right or comes out wrong depends on what it is I'm trying to make, right? What do I have in mind as a maker? Standing, therefore, St. Thomas says, between two intellects, the natural thing is called true insofar as it corresponds with either, right? So there are different senses of truth that can apply to the natural thing. It can be called true with respect to God's mind and how it measures up to the divine plan, or it can be called true with respect to our minds. For insofar as it corresponds to the divine mind, it is called true to the extent that it does what it was ordained to do by the divine intellect. But insofar as it corresponds to a human intellect, the natural thing is called true to the extent that it is apt to cause a true thought about itself, and false to the extent that it is apt to cause a false thought about itself. So one example that I really like of this is, so there's this thing that is sometimes referred to as fool's gold, but it's also referred to as false gold, right? What is false gold? False gold is something that is not gold and yet is colored in such a way that it's apt to make us form a false judgment about it, right? It's apt to make us form the judgment that's gold, right? And so the thing is false gold, right? Why? So it's false to the extent that it's the sort of thing that is highly likely to make us form a false judgment about it, right? And so that's a, so we've said that primarily truth is in the mind in one sense, right? So when we're speculatively knowing, right, gold, right? Or whatever, or fool's gold, right? So when I'm trying to understand fool's gold, what's primarily true is my judgment, my mind. What's secondarily true is the thing, right? And likewise, what's primarily false, my mind, my judgment, what's secondarily false is the thing. How does that work? Well, the thing that's really false, that's like truly false, right? That's sort of robustly false is my judgment. That is gold. The thing is false gold in a kind of secondary sense, derivative sense. Why? Well, because it's the sort of thing that's likely to make me make a false judgment like that. Okay, so now we get the following cascading kinds of distinctions. So let's start with the divine mind, right? So God's practical intellect when he creates the world and all natural things. Well, the divine mind is the measure, and it causes the natural thing, which is measured by the divine mind. So the mind is, the God's mind is what's secondarily true, and what's mainly true in this case of practical intellect is the thing, right? So you are a true Christian when you live up to the measure of a Christian that God has in his mind, right? You're a false Christian to the extent that you fail to live up to what God has in mind for his people, right? You're a true human to the extent that you live up to what God has in mind for humans. And you're a false human to the extent that you fail to do so. Everything flips when we think about our kind of speculative knowledge of things, right? So here it's our minds are measured and are what's primarily true. precisely because our minds have to receive from, you know, the things, the natural things in the world, the natures of cats and dogs and humans and Christians. And those real things are the measure. And so they're only true in a kind of secondary sense. The human practical intellect, so when we're making things, right, is actually structurally a lot closer to the relationship between God's mind and the world than it is to the relationship between, like, the world and our minds, right? So here, it's our human minds, our practical intellects, that are the measure of the thing made, right? And so our minds are only in a kind of secondary sense true, but the artificial thing, the made thing, the fabricated thing, is what's primarily true to the extent that it measures up to what we, the makers, have in mind. Now we can apply this to fantasy literature. Trust me, we can. So, remember what our core question was. Is grimdark fantasy less true or less good than other fantasy subgenres, and in particular, than classic fantasy like Tolkien? Well, we divided that into two sub-questions. Is it less true? Is it less good? We can now give a principled Thomistic answer to each of those sub-questions. So, let's start with truth. Is grimdark fantasy less true than other fantasy subgenres? Contrary to my gut, the answer to this question is no. At least if what we mean is grimdark fantasy somehow essentially or necessarily less true? Why? Well, all art is true to the extent that it measures up to what its maker has in mind. We just saw that, right? So just as natural things are true to the extent that they measure up to God's plan, so too artificial things, which includes novels, right? Poetry and film, right? Art in general, right? That's going to be true to the extent that it measures up to what its maker has in mind. And guess what? Grimdark fantasy is a kind of art, right? So, grimdark fantasy literature is true to the extent that it measures up to what its maker, namely the author, has in mind. But there's nothing about grimdark fantasy that requires that it measure up to the mind of its author less than any other fantasy subgenre, right? So look, you can imagine, you know, George R. R. Martin, right, the author of The Game of Thrones, you know, if you ask him this question, did that book come out the way you wanted it to come out? It's easy to imagine him saying, yeah, it came out almost exactly the way that I wanted it to come out. Actually, I've never been happier with a book that I've written, right? Like all of my other books, like the second book in the series or the third book in the series, I was less satisfied with them. There was something I wanted to communicate and get across in those books that didn't quite come out, right? And so then in that case, the second book or the third book, right, the one that didn't quite capture or express everything that he wanted it to, is going to be less true than the first book, which came out like exactly the way, like almost miraculously, it got everything that he had in mind there, right? We can imagine that scenario. And just like we can imagine exactly that scenario for Tolkien, right? Did the Silmarillion capture like everything that you had in mind when you wrote it? And like we know as a historical matter of fact, unfortunately, no. It didn't, right? There was like, he was always a little bit unsatisfied with some elements of it, right? And so there's a sense in which, you know, the Silmarillion failed to measure up to the mind of its author, right? And so there's nothing about grimdark fantasy that says that it's always going to fail to measure up to what the author has in mind. Nothing about grimdark fantasy requires it to be less true than other fantasy genres, right? Because the truth of the book, the truth of the fantasy story, lies in whether it measures up to the mind of its maker. Very different answer for goodness. Is grimdark fantasy less good than other fantasy subgenres? Not only is our answer yes, but I think our answer is essentially and necessarily yes. Why? Well, all art is good to the extent that it is rightly ordered to God as its final end. Grimdark fantasy literature, in principle, cannot be ordered rightly to God as its final end. So, grimdark fantasy literature cannot be good in the fullest and ultimate sense. So remember, there are three senses of goodness. There's like the first kind of very thin, trivial sense of like transcendental goodness. Then there's like, does it have the characteristic accidents or features that are like typical of it? And so things like, you know, is the prose readable? Is the prose beautiful? You know, that kind of thing. But then the third and fullest sense is, does it achieve its ultimate purpose, right? Is it, you know, golden retrievers like are made to retrieve, right? And so as long as they're not retrieving, they're not fulfilling their final purpose, right? So what I'm submitting to you in this first premise here is that part of the purpose, part of the final end of art is to be ordered to God. And grimdark fantasy literature can't do that, which means grimdark fantasy literature, in principle, will always fail to achieve the third and most important sense of goodness. So why think that those premises are true? Well, here are three arguments. I'm a philosopher, right? So here we go. The nature argument. Look, nature is essentially ordered to God as its final end, right? In fact, we've already seen that in the talk. But art imitates nature. So art is essentially ordered to God as its final end, right? We're not creative in the sense that God is creative. We don't create ex nihilo. We start with what God has created in the world around us and then are creative on the basis of that. But that is ordered to God. Here's a different argument. Human action is essentially ordered to God as its final end because we are made for God. Art is a kind of human action. So art is essentially ordered to God as its final end. And here's a universal argument. Everything is essentially ordered to God as its final end, right? Art's a thing. So art is essentially ordered to God as its final end, right? It's if you believe in God, right, it is literally impossible for there to be anything that isn't ordered to God, right? So spot me this one premise that God exists, and I can give you the universal argument. So what about the second premise? Well, here's just an argument from Sullivan's description of grimdark fantasy, right? So look, I submit to you that anything that presents as true the idea that, quote, there is no possibility for joy and no reason to aspire to anything because in the end there is no chance of a better life or greater good, that worldview cannot be rightly ordered to God as its final end. It just can't. But guess what? Grimdark fantasy literature presents exactly that as true, which means grimdark fantasy literature cannot be rightly ordered to God as its final end. We can also give a similar argument on the basis of Bork's description, right? So anything the defining characteristic of which is the retreat into the valorization of darkness for darkness's sake, into a kind of nihilism that portrays right action in terms of personal morality as either impossible or futile, that's just not orderable to God as its final end, right? That is contrary to God's plan and the story of salvation history that God is telling. But grimdark fantasy has that as its defining characteristic. So it can't be rightly ordered to God as its final end. So yes, Tolkien is better. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.